listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More fighting and war plagued Yemen. Dozens of Saudi-sponsored militia members loyal to Yemen's former president, Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi, were killed, and scores of others injured when Yemeni army forces fired missiles at their base in the country's southwestern province of Taiz. According to a military source in Yemen, speaking on a condition of anonymity, as reported by Press TV, Yemeni soldiers and their allies launched a Qahir 2M missile at Al-Qayyama base Monday afternoon. The source said that the attack left more than 30 Hadi loyalists dead and more than 20 others injured. At least 13,600 people have been killed since the onset of Saudi Arabia's military campaign against Yemen in 2015. Much of the country's infrastructure, including hospitals, schools, and factories, has been reduced to rubble as a consequence of the bombings. The Saudi-led war also triggered a deadly cholera epidemic across Yemen, which, according to the World Health Organization's latest count, has killed more than 2,100 people since the end of April of 2017 and is suspected to have infected more than 800,000. Press TV's Mohammed Al-Attab, reporting from Yemen's capital of Sana'a, has more.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen continues to worsen. The United Nations has now launched a $3 billion appeal for the country where the Saudi war, looming famine, and the outbreak of diseases claim more lives each day. The UN humanitarian coordinator in Yemen says the figures of the people affected in the country are staggering.
And the figures of those people affected in this country are quite staggering. Some 22 million people need some kind of humanitarian assistance or protection. And half of that number, that's over 11 million people, are in a category we call in acute need, which are people who are really living on life's edge. So basically what the plan is to ask for, we're asking for $2.95 billion. $2.95 billion, to try and target 13 million people in this country.
The UN official added that the aid was aimed at providing the only lifeline for millions of people. He also said many people were dying in Yemen due to the shortage of medicine. Furthermore, millions of people have been forced by the Saudi war to flee their homes. The province of Ebb is among the destinations where the internally displaced persons have been seeking refuge. Hamida is one of the displaced Yemenis. She's the mother of five orphans who was forced to flee Saudi Arabia's airstrikes and move to the city of Ebb.
My husband was killed in one of the airstrikes. He provided us with enough food and our life was stable. Here in this abandoned market, we suffer from the cold winter nights. We lack food, water, blankets, and even essential medicines. Most of the time we eat bread dipped in tea and no aid has reached our doorstep.
Millions of Yemenis like Hamida are living with the hope that the war will come to an end one day. Rights groups believe the only way to bring that day closer is to draw the attention of the world to the high humanitarian cost of the war. Saudi Arabia attacked Yemen in 2015 with the aim of bringing to power the former president Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi. However, it has so far failed to achieve its objective, and the bombing campaign has left nothing but a trail of death and destruction. Mohammed Attab, Press TV, Sana'a.
The UN has been ineffective in providing aid to the people of Yemen. The Saudis have locked up all of the ports, and road access has been curtailed completely, blocking the delivery of aid to Yemen's people. And an announcement today at the United Nations in New York indicated yet another complication for the delivery of aid and the solution of the problem of the war facing the Yemeni people. This was the spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, Stéphane Dujarric, at the UN on Monday.
The UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed, has informed the Secretary General that he does not intend to continue in his position beyond the end of his current contract, which ends in February of this year. The Special Envoy takes the opportunity to express his sincere thanks to the Secretary General for his strong and determined support to reach a political solution to the conflict that has engulfed the country. In this moment, the thoughts of Mr. Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed go first with the Yemeni people, who are worn out by this conflict and are enduring one of the most devastating humanitarian crises in the world. The Special Envoy remains committed to pursue through diplomacy an end to the violence and a political solution that meets the legitimate aspirations of the Yemeni people until a successor is named. And I'd like to add that the envoy yesterday concluded a four-day visit to Saudi Arabia, where he met with the Yemeni president and the Minister of Foreign Affairs, as well as a number of Yemeni political and government figures.
While the world has waited to figure out exactly what could be done for the people of Yemen, according to UNICEF last year, more than 11 million children in that country were in acute need of aid. UNICEF stressed that it was estimated that every 10 minutes, a child died of a preventable disease there. In addition, the UN has described the current level of hunger in Yemen as unprecedented, emphasizing that 17 million people were food insecure in the country. The World Body said that 6.8 million, meaning almost 1 in 4 of the population, do not have enough food and rely entirely on external assistance. That situation may be about to change, however. On Monday, there was a press conference in Moscow held jointly by Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Yemen's Deputy Prime Minister, who also serves as Foreign Minister, Abdelmalek al-Mikhlafi. Al-Mikhlafi represents the government that's headed by Hadi and is being resisted by popular forces in Yemen. This was Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov opening the press conference.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have concluded our substantive talks. We discussed in detail the political and military situation in Yemen and the prospects of a settlement of the crisis in the country. We also looked at some of the aspects on our bilateral agenda. We think that there is no alternative to the cessation of hostility at an early date in Yemen. We think all the parties should refrain from any attempts to resolve the existing contradictions through the use of force. We think it is necessary not only to continue, but actually to boost international efforts, with the UN playing the leading role to create conditions for lasting dialogue with all the political forces in Yemen. We think that the arrangements for political settlements in Yemen, prepared in different formats and imposed from outside, will not be viable and may even be counterproductive. Only the people of Yemen themselves can decide the future of their country. And Russia maintains contacts with all the parties in Yemen, and we are ready to provide necessary assistance. And it is our understanding that the leadership of the Republic of Yemen welcomes this stance of Russia. We devoted a lot of attention to the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which remains extremely complex. According to UN estimates, 22 million people in Yemen, and that's a huge number, need assistance, and over 2 million children are starving. So Russia welcomes the decision by the Arab coalition to partially lift the blockade of Hodeida, the only artery that connects the cities, the country's biggest city with the north. We think that the UN should continue to have access to Sana'a for humanitarian airlifts. And long-term, more fundamentally, it is important to lift the sea and air blockade and open free access for medical supplies and food to all the territories. Russia contributes to humanitarian efforts in Yemen. Last year, the Emergencies Ministry sent over 40 tons of humanitarian cargo to Sana'a, and we are now working on another humanitarian delivery to the Republic of Yemen. Unfortunately, as a result of this lasting conflict, basically all the bilateral projects in trade and economic cooperation between Russia and Yemen have been frozen. We will be ready, and we think that our counterparts are interested to resume our ties as soon as peace and stability return to Yemen. Our people are interested in that, especially considering that we have a long history of a good relations between our countries. In December, we'll mark 100 years since we established diplomatic relations. We have agreed with Mr. Minister to continue regular contacts directly and through our embassy in the Republic of Yemen, which recently was moved from Sana'a to Riyadh for security reasons. At the same time, we'll continue our dialogue with Houthis and other political forces in Yemen, with all the stakeholders, including the Arab coalition, which plays an important role in the situation in Yemen, encouraging everybody to contribute to pacifying the situation and moving on from the military conflict to a political dialogue. Thank you.
And these were the opening comments of Yemen's acting deputy prime minister and foreign minister.
I'd like to thank my counterpart, Minister Lavrov. We just had very constructive negotiations. We discussed the situation in Yemen, our bilateral agenda and prospects for the development of our bilateral ties. We also discussed the decision by U.S. President Donald Trump to move its embassy to Jerusalem. The Arab countries have a unanimous position, and that's why we welcomed Russia's support for the pan-Arab position. Indeed, our relations are long-standing, and as Minister said, on January the 1st, we'll mark the 90th anniversary since the establishment of diplomatic ties between Yemen and Russia.
I've handed
over a welcoming note from the Yemeni leadership to the Russian leadership, and also we recognize Russia's support for the legitimate Yemeni government. During the talks, we reaffirmed our support to every initiative, including the Gulf Initiative and UN Security Council resolutions, including UN Security Council Resolution 2216. This is the only option for us that would bring peace and security and restore territorial integrity and independence. I've reaffirmed to Minister Lavrov that the peace option is the only option for us, and the war was declared upon us by the militants who initiated riot against legitimate authorities. Today we discussed Russia's role and Russia's support for the peace process. Russia is a permanent member of the UN Security Council and plays its role at the UN and in implementing all international resolutions.
Мы считаем, что ООНовские рамки урегулирования являются единственным форматом по достижению мира.
The UN framework is the only path towards peace in Yemen.
Россия في هذا الجانب كأحد الدول الدائمة العضوية.
И здесь, соответственно, мы считаем, что Россия
играет
важных ролей как стране постоянному члену Совбеза.
Has one of the leading roles since it's a permanent member of the UN Security Council. It's one of the co-sponsors of the peace process since 2011. We very much hope that our contacts and consultations will continue. We agreed to intensify them. As for the Yemeni legitimate government, it continues to support the UN efforts and the special UN envoy. We've agreed to the results of negotiations in Kuwait and other areas. Houthis are against the peace process. They set up barriers, and the latest obstacle was the killing of former President Saleh.
This was confirmed
during the talks between the President Hadi and UN Special Envoy, and our President said the same during the meeting with the Presidential Special Envoy for the Middle East, Mikhail Bogdanov.
I've
expressed gratitude to you, Minister Lavrov, for the humanitarian aid that Russia has provided. We indeed have a dire humanitarian situation. This is the consequence of the war. The war was imposed upon us. And there's only one alternative. There's only one option. Getting back to normal, stopping the war and restoring state institutions. This will be the ultimate solution, but until that happens, we are working on a new plan, that's the so-called rescue plan.
According to it,
all border checkpoints
will be reopened,
there will be humanitarian corridors
opened
for the aid to pour in.
And it is today that the ministerial summit of the coalition will take place
that will discuss this particular issue.
They will come together to discuss this
coalition-led plan.
We believe that the Yemeni people deserve peace.
Today, during our talks,
I asked
a Russian counterpart to send 50,000 tons of grain,
and Minister Lavrov said that this request is now being considered.
We very much hope that the reply would be positive, because we know that Russia is committed.
Just 50 tons,
not 50,000 tons, but 50 tons of grain.
We also discussed
the consequences of the killing of President Saleh
and the situation in the ruling party.
We share the same opinion on this issue.
We would like this process to be an inclusive one.
We also discussed aspects of our bilateral ties, implementation of some bilateral projects,
including those related to the prisoners.
We would like to continue strengthening our ties.
We very much appreciate Russia's role.
We cherish the historical ties that we have with Russia,
and we hope that Russia will continue the peace process
in line with the decisions that have been made.
And we very much hope, and we told it to the Prime Minister, to the Foreign Minister, that Iran stops interfering in our affairs.
Lavrov and Al-Mikhlafi took questions from the assembled journalists in Moscow, and we bring you some of that here.
Egyptian TV channel.
Здравствуйте, уважаемый Сергей Викторович.
Minister Lavrov.
Как Россия оценивает ситуацию в Йемене?
Russia's assessment of the situation in Yemen after the killing of former president Mr. Saleh.
Вазир Лавров. Могу вот таким Русия лауда фил Йемен бада ихтияль раиса сабик Али Абдулла Салех.
Ну прежде всего,
first of all,
это произошло,
when this happened, we said it was a grave crime, obviously planned in order to disrupt efforts for peaceful settlement.
As you
know,
Али Абдулла Салех was in favor of building bridges with the government of President Hadi in order to stop bloodshed.
We had a feeling that
very soon Ansarullah will be fully isolated and the situation will be resolved even without any political talks.
The
situation looks much more complex. Mr. Minister has just mentioned the situation in the National Congress,
where there is a party in favor of the talks, and there are also hardliners who are in favor of continuing confrontation with the legitimate government of Yemen.
هناك أكثر من تيار هناك الذين يدعمون التفاوض وهناك الذين يريدون اتخاذ المواقف الأكثر قصوة ويريدون استمرار الحرب ضد الحكومة الشرعية.
Все это лишь подтверждает, что альтернативы переходу.
All this demonstrates that there is no alternative to launching pan-Yemeni talks. We share this position with the Yemeni government and will continue advancing this position in our contacts with all the parties in Yemen.
وهذا هو موقفنا المشترك مع الحكومة الشرعية اليمنية ونحن سنستمر بترويج هذا الموقف في الاتصالات المستقبلية مع كافة الأطراف اليمنية وجميع اللاعبين الخارجيين.
RT. Роман Козырев, RT English.
Сергей Викторович, уже несколько дней продолжается турецкая военная операция против курдов на севере Сирии.
Special operation against Kurds is now in its third day. The Kurds have been backed by the US. What is Russia's assessment of the operation? What is your assessment of the moderate response by the US to the situation? Will it have an impact on Kurds' role in the Syrian peace process?
فيما يخص بالعملية التركية ضد الأكراد في الشمال السوري الأكراد المدعومين من أمريكا ما هو موقف موسكو من هذه العملية ولستم مستغربون من ردة الفعل المتواضعة من واشنطن وأيضا السؤال هل ستؤثر هذه التطورات على مكانة ودورة الأكراد في التسوية السياسية؟
Ну, во-первых, наверняка уже ознакомились с теми заявлениями, которые получали из Москвы в связи с началом
операции regarding the launch of the military operation in Afrin. There was a statement by the Foreign Ministry and a statement by the Defense Ministry. We encouraged all parties to respect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of the Arab Republic of Syria.
В этой связи напомню, что мы уже давно.
I would like to remind everybody that we have been pointing out for a long time that the United States pursues a policy of setting up alternative government bodies throughout the large part of Syrian territories.
يتبعون نهجا لتشكيل هيئة الحكم البديلة في الأراضي الشاسعة في سوريا.
Вашингтон осуществляет открытые,
Washington,
да и неафишируемые поставки
openly and also covertly provides modern weapons to different groups in Syria,
сотрудничают прежде всего силам демократической Сирии, опирающимся на
democratic Syrian forces, which rely on Kurdish militia.
علني وبشكل سري تقدم أحدث أنواع الأسلحة الفصائل الموجودة في سوريا التي تتعاون معها أقصد هون قوات سوريا الديمقراطية المؤلفة من الميليشيات الكردية.
В развитии этой линии на грубое вмешательство во внутренние дела Сирийской Арабской Республики.
This meddling in the internal affairs of the Syrian Arab Republic continues as several days ago the creation of a borderline force was declared along the entire border with Turkey and Iran.
سياده سوريه قبل ايام جاء الاعلان الامريكي حول انشاء قوات الامن الحدوديه على طول الحدود السوريه التركيه والسوريه العراقيه.
Затем прозвучали достаточно неуклюжие опровержения, хотя по факту вся эта деятельность,
in reality, all those activities aimed at establishing control over Syrian territory along the border continued.
At
the same time, the United States has been discouraging Kurds from having dialogue with Damascus.
Washington
encourages a separatist sentiment among Kurds, ignoring the delicate nature and the regional dimension of the Kurdish
issue.
Стремясь понять мотивы такой политики Вашингтона, ну, ничего не остается, кроме как предположить, что это
don't understand the motives for such policy by Washington. It's either that they don't understand the situation, or this is an intentional provocation.
Что касается
Now, as regards the role that the Kurds may play in the further political process, they certainly should play a role.
Но она должна быть обеспечена на
But this role should be secured based on a common platform where all the Syrian ethnic, religious, and political forces are encouraged to respect Syria's territorial integrity and sovereignty. That's why Kurdish representatives were invited to the upcoming Congress Syrian National Congress, which will take place next week in Sochi.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart, off Europe but not with it. For centuries, both Russia and the United Kingdom struggled to define their relationship with continental Europe. Over the last few years, both seem to have decided to go their separate ways, and yet both seem to be pulled back. What does Europe think of it, and what is Europe after all? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Giuliana Amata, former Prime Minister of Italy and now the country's Constitutional Court judge. Mr. Amata, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time. Now, about 2 years ago, you wrote about how a dangerous cultural divide is now growing between Russia and the West. I wonder if your sense of concern has been allayed since then, or has it, on the contrary, intensified?
Well, I don't know whether it has intensified. Certainly, it is still there. And the more I think of it, the more it seems to me a sort of nonsense, economic, political, and also historical. In my view, something has happened of which we are responsible that has created again in this country, in Russia, the sense of being surrounded by others who don't really want us, I mean you, as partners or allied, but somehow that, as I was saying, are defending themselves against us. Now, this goes back to the old history you will know of this country and makes it unacceptable, to make it very clear and short. In my view, it was a mistake to bring NATO directly to the borders of Russia.
Well, I'm sure many people in Russia would agree with you on that point, but I personally don't think that's the only point of contention here. But I want to see something that you mentioned in that very same article, the point that I haven't heard anyone else make, and that is that Russia's criticism toward Western countries is similar to the grievances that the jihadist movements espouse towards the West. What made you reach that conclusion?
No, the fact that these identitarian culture that is growing again inside the Russian soul brings with itself a distance between your society and our societies. This distance is underlined by a sort of criticism that is similar to the criticism of Muslim integralist people, such as the West with valueless societies, the West materialistic, the West against the holy values around which a community is formed. Now, this goes, let's say, behind Solzhenitsyn, the holy notion of the Mother Russia, etc., and creates actually a distance. This is something that I found frightening, because the diffusion of this kind of criticism really creates a deep gap.
But Mr. Amada, if I may interject here, I think this is a very interesting observation. I think it's also very true, but I would point to you that what lies at the root of jihadist sentiment toward the West is not some cultural separation, but primarily the sense of injustice, the sense of an indignity, the bloodshed, the suffering that Western countries brought into many Arab societies.
Yeah,
I'm sure they were driven by good intentions. The West always thinks that it's doing the right thing, but I think what matters to the afflicted country is not the intentions, but the actual results. Yeah. Don't you think that Russia has the reason to be concerned that the same kind of do-gooding would be visited upon it by the Western countries?
Yeah. I see an enormous difference here between the two situations, but I wouldn't deepen this point much more than needed, because if we solve a problem that exists between us nowadays, and it is the Ukrainian problem, probably all of these differences can be watered down little by little, restoring the common narrative that existed years ago. So I don't think that it is necessarily so. You know, all of us have a dark side. The problem is whether we do things that allow us to keep it compressed.
You mentioned the dark side, and I have lots of friends in the West who believe that Russia needs to be saved from itself, that it is set on spreading
its... We ourselves have to be saved from our dark side.
Exactly, but what people in the West think is that Russia is trying to spread its vices, you know, corruption, nepotism, authoritarianism, and what the West thinks of itself is that it is spreading its virtues, you know, democracy and human rights.
This is not my point.
In the case
of Ukraine, it is not so.
Because the corrupted side of
that country is not protected by Russia.
But the choice that was presented before the Ukrainians was either you stay with this dark country to your east, the Mordor, Russia, which is forever doomed to authoritarianism, or you join our Western club and they are perfect values.
No, not necessarily so. It was simply you are here at the eastern periphery of the Union, you can join the Union. Not necessarily
can
creating...
Can they join the Union, though?
At the moment, I would say take it easy. I can't do anything because I'm only an old man. But I think that solving the problem we have with Russia is a priority. And reducing the pressure around its borders is a priority. But of course, inside that country, Russia has a responsibility now, which is also vis-a-vis international law, as you well know. But I don't want to put the things in these terms. I simply say, let us take this idea of the ceasefire seriously. Let us do it.
But Mr. Amada, I appreciate you mentioning international law, because I think it's this question is absolutely central to the differences between the current challenges between Russia and the West, because the law, you may argue that the law, international law, was transgressed in Ukraine, but it was also transgressed in Libya, it was also transgressed in Iraq. I think in Syria nobody even pretends that it exists anymore. And I'm sure as a constitutional lawyer, this issue would be very near and dear to your heart, the law not only as a mechanism of justice, but as a mechanism of restraint. How can we bring back the respect to the international law back into international politics?
Well, this is a very good question, and it implies, I suppose, this is my personal view, should we Europeans really adopt a common foreign policy? I'm convinced that a common foreign policy would abide international law much more easily. As you well know, the intervention in Libya was decided by one place plus one European countries, not by the European Union. It could never have been a European initiative.
But Italy still eagerly participated in it, so Italy perhaps would have done it either way.
Italy participated in a sort of...
in the NATO bombing of Tripoli.
A sort of third stage, but in any event, I'm not here to defend Italy. I'm here to explain to you that when Altiero Spinelli and the founding fathers of the European idea said we have to federate the states, what was the reason for it? The reason was because as long as they enjoy exclusive sovereignty, they will be aggressive to others and they will violate the rules. This has continued despite the European Union, mostly because the European Union is not sufficiently a union in foreign policy.
But what makes you believe that even if you strengthen the mechanisms of integration, if you make them more formal, that those inner tendencies will be reined in? Because there is as we know, in politics, there is always a formal way, but when the formal way doesn't work, you can always circumvent.
This is not a matter of formalities. This is a matter of sharing decisions, and therefore in making these decisions operative only after the necessary consensus has been reached. Around the European Union table, the decision to attack Libya could not have been taken. What can I tell you? Believe me, I have no other, because this is a counterfactual history, and history is another one. But I'm still convinced that federating states is very useful to reduce their aggressive propensities.
But it was not, that's the thing, it was not an act of aggression. I think back in 2011, it was seen as a humanitarian intervention
and an attempt to do something good. It was basically eliminating Gaddafi.
So you don't think it was trying to spread the European and Western values?
Absolutely not. It was eliminating Gaddafi.
There is an opinion here in Russia that one of the reasons why the United States and to some extent Western Europe make the foreign policy decisions that they make is that because they have been for long insulated from the consequences of those decisions. Now, Europe obviously is no longer insulated from its policy, from the consequences of its foreign policy in the Middle East and North Africa. You're dealing with lots of migrants coming into your country. It is putting a serious challenge to you and compounding many other challenges that you face at the moment. Do you think that may, in a way, sober up the decision-making when it comes to international politics, at least as far as the European
You know, in international matters, we are not so integrated and so successful as we are in economic matters. This is undoubtedly so. We have been successful also in recognizing individual rights and spreading them on an equal basis into all of our member states.
Do you think you've become a victim of your own success in that way?
Not at all. We have not been successful in international matters. That's the point. This is where national sovereignty has remained. But it is so clear, when we tried to fix it up, and we adopted also new sort of gears, well, international politics remained as a prerogative of the member states. I mean, it's not normal. Why? Because there are the external relationships of the community and the foreign policies of the individual member states. And the poor high representative has to represent both. So this is not a success. This is a difficult compromise. Immigration is one of these areas where from outside people tend to see Europe as a sort of unique single land. This makes the thing very difficult with countries like Italy and Greece that are the gates, as we say, of Europe, but are forced to behave as if the immigrants landing both in Greece and in Italy were for Italy and Greece only. So this is the asymmetry that still remains.
Well, Mr. Amada, we have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Giuliana Amato, former Prime Minister of Italy. Mr. Amato, just before the break, we were talking about law being influenced by political considerations internationally, but obviously it also happens in the domestic landscape. We have a major issue with independent judiciary here in Russia, but it also seems to be increasingly an issue in other European countries, like, for example, Poland or Ukraine. And those countries, rhetorically at least, have long embraced the Western way. Is that really an issue of values? Why do you think it's so difficult to insulate politics and the judiciary in the domestic context?
As a constitutional law scholar, I find it very much understandable that after years of communism, the notion of concentration of power prevails upon the notion of division of powers, because the communist regime was based formally.
But I mean, they had more than a decade after the communism to foster
the separation
of powers.
When I was discussing with others the operation that was necessary for these new states to enter into the European Union, building a market out of a communist economy, building liberal democratic states out of communist states, the highest difficulty was in the second part, not in the first one. And precisely because of this reason, creating an independent judiciary, I can tell you that this is sometimes difficult also in Western Europe.
Now, the European Commission is now censuring Poland for misbehaving, and Poland essentially responds by saying that it's not your business. And I think that touches on the subject that you often talk about, which is the supremacy of national law versus the primacy of EU regulations. I suspect that your heart would be with the European Commission, but do you see any merit in the Polish argument that they should be allowed some space of making their own decisions and some space to develop their democracy the way they seem necessary?
Well, I mean, there are limits, of course. Diversities in the huge construction like the European Union should be not eliminated but absorbed, as somebody has written. Having said so, there are limits. So all of us have accepted that we respect the rule of law. We consider the independence of the judiciary part of the rule of law, something that from the Polish viewpoint can be argued, perhaps, I'm not sure, they could say, but appointing judges is not necessarily somehow threatening their independence, because if you argue that appointing judges excludes the independence of the judiciary, the U.S. is out of the rule of law, because we know that federal judges are appointed by the president. So there is a sort of a margin of discussion, but within limits, really, because what has happened in Poland in relation to the Constitutional Court is, let me say so, beyond credibility.
Now, the Financial Times had an article the other day saying that Poland was where the Soviet Empire began to crumble, and that it may well be the place where the future of the EU will be decided. Do you agree with that?
No.
Why not?
Not at all. Not at all. No, because Poland is an important European country. It's one of the big ones, after all. And whatever happens in Poland affects the Union. This is something I'm convinced. But not that Poland will lead the Union toward its disruption. This is something I don't think. There is something that has to do with Kaczynski. Give Tusk the time to go back to his country. Things might change, and all of this sort of eternity of the present might change.
But you know, one parallel I would draw with the Soviet Union first, even two parallels, I think. One is this intention by the Soviet Union to centrally mandate policies rather than let the regions to develop at their own pace. And the second one would be the very linear view of history and progress, that you only go from a certain point to the next point without allowing a country or society to make its own mistakes. Isn't it helpful, ultimately, for the democratic process, for Poland, for Hungary, for Russia, for Ukraine, for anyone else, to make its own mistakes and to strengthen that democratic muscle?
There is a limit to that, because something that is very important for us is not to be only a common market, but, as we say, to be a community of values. You might make your own mistakes, but if you steadily and permanently contradict the common values, you create a problem. Absolutely, you create a problem. Also, on the outside fronts, because we need to be perceived as that community of value. There is something that we are very affectionate to. The fact that no member of the European Union can accept the death penalty, and no third country still adopting the death penalty can be accepted as a member of the Union. Imagine that we accept a country to make its own mistake adopting the death penalty without reacting.
But Mr. Amara, I could tell you that Italy has had its own very long history. You have pages in your history that I'm sure you're not very proud of, fascism, for example, and yet you managed to build your society on it. When you say that all countries have to comply with certain values, don't you deny them an opportunity to arrive at the appreciation of those values by themselves, rather than being mandated by some central authority.
They are not mandated. Don't adopt this view of Brussels as if it were a Soviet power that from Moscow tries to dominate a wide territory and several communities. It is not so. The only powers that the Commission now has are soft powers, not so aggressive.
Well, certainly you do not send tanks to
there is a point that you rightly raise that has been perceived. Don't leave the Commission with its soft powers, but soft. Open up a dialogue among the member states, all of them discussing with each other the respect of the rule of law that exists in each of them. That, because you will find that perhaps the violations by Poland are macro, others might be minor, but look at the rights of migrants, how they are treated in each of our countries. You will realize that the rule of law is a splendid rule, but the compliance with it is not so splendid also in other countries. This has to be done. The dialogue, but it's a dialogue. It's not a Soviet power on the poor Poland.
Well, good to know. Can I ask you very quickly about another country that is involved in negotiations with the EU, and that is the United Kingdom? I know that you were greatly disappointed by the results of the Brexit vote, even though you yourself wrote that Article 50. Did you ever think that it would have been invoked?
No, my purpose in proposing and somehow shaping the three paragraphs of that article was, if they have it, they won't use it. Because frequently they had said, oh, you are doing so many things difficult to accept for us, and it's impossible to walk out. It's impossible to walk out. We are prisoners of this bureaucracy of Brussels, etc. Said, no, okay, the door is there and you can open it. So feel more relaxed inside the Union. But the fact of the matter is that those who voted on that occasion gave a majority to Brexit. Now it has to be seen whether under the light of the actual conditions that are not defined as yet of the exit, they will really be ready to do it. I consider this issue open, but it's too early to say.
Can I ask you specifically about that? Because I heard you express that hope of the British reconsidering their decision before. And I wonder if it's fair to continental Europe to just sit there and wait for the UK to decide for another time whether it wants
to stay with it or not. No, but this is not what Europe is doing. This is what I think. But Europe is negotiating with a very rigid timetable. They have concluded the first stage of negotiations, which is the stage devoted to how much it costs to you to leave. And they have found somehow an agreement which has allowed them to open up the second stage of negotiations, which relates not to the past, the cost, but to the future. These will be the real negotiations, and the time is very limited until next year.
The Brexit vote was ultimately a result of a very self-serving political decision. You can argue that what we see now transpire in Poland is also a result of self-serving politics. Do you think the EU is treating Poland and the UK by the same standard in this case? Because it seems to be that it's much stricter on Poland than on the UK.
Difficult for me to put the two situations on the same kind of benchmark, because Poland is a member of the Union that has no intention to leave.
Even though Mr. Tusk said that that could be a possibility if Poland is pressed too hard.
Well, but I mean, there is always a possibility. But at the moment, Poland is a member state that perhaps is violating common values. The UK, which has not violated any common value, has expressed the view to leave. And therefore, we are negotiating with them. It has to be clear. If they don't want migrants easily entering into their territory, they have to set a rigid border between Northern Ireland and the Ireland Republic. If they don't want a rigid border between the two Irelands, Lampedusa will be in Dublin. And this is the intractable problem that they have created to themselves. It's not my fault.
Well, Mr. Amada, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your time. And to our viewers, please keep the conversation going on our social media pages. And I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.